boys and girls. Welcome back. Henrik here with Red Ice TV. Thank you so much for tuning in. It was a pleasure having you here. Today we're going to take an excursion into the spiritual world. As you know, many years ago, but in the past on this show, we've covered a lot of esoteric, occult topics. We've covered things, in terms of spiritual searching, and spiritual nature, trying to find a deeper meaning to things, basically. And of course, it was a few years ago when I personally started looking into my own, heritage, if you will, of my Nordic tradition, started traveling around to different spots around in Sweden, visiting runestones, visiting burial mounds, visiting all these wonderful sites that we never were taught about in school. And something was kind of awakened in me. But before that point, of course, it was a deep search for some kind of meaning, for something a little bit more significant. And our guest today, I think, we'll ask him more about this, but have kind of gone through a similar journey in terms of the fact that we begin always looking outward. We look at other traditions. We look far, far away before we kind of return back home, if you will. So our guest today is Aki Cederberg, who joins us from Finland today. We're going to talk about his book, Journeys in the Kali Yuga. Welcome, Aki. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Henrik. It's nice to be here and happy Ostara.
Indeed, exactly. It's a good time. We're a little bit after the spring equinox here, of course, but it's a good time. Easter is coming up. A lot of good stuff. We're going to maybe get into some of that later, actually, and talk about some of the, kind of traditions and stuff like that. But just tell us about yourself a little bit first, and before we kind of get into the book and how we ended up writing on the Eastern tradition and then kind of transforming into the Western and eventually the Nordic tradition. But for those who are new to you, tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I'm a musician, a writer, a traveler, filmmaker from Finland. And I was born in Helsinki, Finland, and then ended up traveling a lot, going very far from my home. And as you said, we go and we explore all these faraway traditions and kind of outer places, then only to kind of return home. So that's been kind of my passage. It's been kind of going these concentric circles, going very far, and then ending up closer and closer, and then you end up home, because home is ultimately what human beings search for, a home in a deeper sense, not just a physical place, but a sense of a spiritual and mythic homeland, a sense of belonging somewhere. So I had always had these I don't know if they're visions or images or dreams inside of me. These are some of my earliest memories. I just have memories of kind of these places where I am, and I have a sense of being at home and being at the source of everything. And when I grew up into a young man, I started looking for these places in the external world, in the spiritual world, these kind of places where I would feel the same kind of sense of a deeper connection, a deeper home. And I then, of course, very quickly ended up at my own traditions, that being the tradition, spiritual tradition of Finland and the spiritual traditions of Northern Europe more generally. And I moved to England to live with this kind of pagan brotherhood when I was about 18 years old. And we were trying to then live and practice a kind of paganism rooted in tradition as much as possible, and do practice these things in the modern world. But my experience there was wonderful, but it also showed me the greatest deficit, the greatest lack in the European spiritual world, which is that our living traditions of authority and our figures of authority have been cut. So we no longer have these living embodiments of our traditions. We have written texts, written often by Christian scholars later, for instance, and we have folklore and stuff like that, but we have kind of lost our living connections to our own traditions. So I guess that's one reason why I then traveled to India, which still houses one of the world's oldest living spiritual traditions. And you could argue if the Hindu tradition can be called pagan, in a sense, I think it can. You know, it's of course pre-Christian, and somehow it has survived the ultimate test, that being the test of time. So even though it has been tried to, India has been conquered by Islam, the Muslims, and then later Christians, but somehow they have kept their traditions going throughout all this time, and they still have these living embodiments of these traditions, these kind of shamans who keep this tradition vital. And so that's what I traveled there to find, in a way, so that I could see my own traditions more clearly in a better light. That's maybe a long introduction, but that's basically what this book is about, which I've written over the course of about 10 years.
No, that's very interesting, very good. It's easy, I think, to go to other traditions when we grew up in a country that kind of doesn't really recognize our own, right? There isn't much focus on it. I don't know how things are in Finland, but I just know growing up in Sweden how extremely little focus there was on the native tradition there. It was, if there was any talk of a native tradition, it was like the Sami tradition, and we almost got the same things that the Americans get with the Native Americans, right? The Indian Americans, that, you know, we took their land or something. You know, it's almost a guilt complex associated with our own heritage, which gives it a lot of baggage. So if you're not prone to kind of investigate that a little bit deeper and further, I think it's very easy for people to just go far, far away and look for something else. And although I must say, and I want to get your take on this, but there seems obviously to be a connection here, the Indo-European, or what some people call Indo-Aryan tradition, with the Buddhist kind of tradition and stuff, that there is kind of a link, an ancient link. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that.
And so do you think that, is it that why people, maybe also many Europeans, are attracted to Buddhism and to those kinds of traditions? Because on some level, it still resonates with them. It's something in the core of that, at least, that kind of coincides with their own traditions, perhaps.
Definitely. I think there is a lot of overlap in the mythology. How should I describe it? Like the mythological worlds of India and of Europe. And there's even a lot of linguistic similarities. There's theories that, for instance, Finnish language preserves a lot of these old Indo-European words, like Vajra, which is the thunderbolt of Indra, is Vasara, for instance, in Finnish language. I mean, we have these kind of word resemblances to things. But I think on a deeper level, the way to approach the holy is very similar in Europe as it is in India. If you look at the pre-Christian pagan traditions, the way to see the world as alive with these subtle forces, gods and spirits, and to see that the gods are like immanent, they're both immanent and transcendent. They're not abstractions beyond nature, but they kind of reside in nature and we can communicate with them. And these ancient figures, like if you look at Hinduism, one of the central gods of Hinduism is Shiva. And Shiva, in his older form as Rudra, the howler, has many similarities to Odin or Wotan of the north, and also to Väinämöinen. He is this liminal being, this traveler between worlds, this seeker, eternal seeker of knowledge, who always wants to go farther and deeper and longer, and to discover the secrets of the universe, and hangs out in dubious company with, both Shiva and Odin do have their kind of entourage, their troop of sometimes very ghoulish figures and so forth. So I think I'm not a scholar in an academic sense of history, so perhaps somebody else would be better to talk about these historical similarities, but in a spiritual way, I think there are many, many similarities, and the ways of of how you practice your religion are, you can sort of immediately understand them when you go there. At least that's the way it was for me. It's very like, it feels very natural to me to understand why they do this. And this is because the idea of a paganism or a spiritual tradition, and we have to remember that when I talk of Hinduism, so-called Hinduism, the Sanatana Dharma, as a pagan tradition, I'm simply meaning it in terms of it is a folkish religion versus the traditions, spiritual traditions of the peoples of India. So it is like their natural view, their natural way to approach the holy. And this is what all genuine paganism is the natural way a people perceives and relates to the holy. So this is what I think about this.
Yeah, interesting. So tell us a bit about your experiences in India then, and also why, I mean, not everyone would go there, not everyone have that drive to kind of search for something deeper, not everyone does, you know, pickups and leaves or travels and stuff like that. Was there just a general interest that you had in this, or did you just, was this a spiritual quest from the get-go that you needed to find something deeper? Tell us more about that.
Well, my ancestors from my father's side were all priests and doctors, and from my mother's side it's been all seamen. So I've always kind of thought that I have these two ancestral streaks very strongly in my psyche. And so I've always had this longing for the sacred, the holy. And I've always had a sense for a longing for faraway places and travel and to go to distant lands, the sense of adventure and wanderlust. And it was never for me like that I went there simply to be some sort of tourist and look at things from the outside and be like, oh, this is interesting. It was always motivated by a spiritual, you know, it was very clear to me that this is a pilgrimage. This is a journey made with the intent of going beyond my normal world into some sort of extraordinary world in order to find something. You know, we have a lot of this kind of exoticism in the West where people just kind of gather exotic experiences and radical experiences in faraway places. And they kind of like just kind of gather extreme experiences. But my point was never that, but it was to find something genuine and then kind of bring it back and incorporate it into my life. And maybe also give something of my experience to other people, to my people.
Mm.
Because I find it, you know, as you said, that when you were young and you weren't really, you know, these kind of perhaps Swedish ancient faith wasn't really discussed in school so much and it wasn't really talked about so much. It was the same for me, you know. I consider it a great tragedy that I grew up. And I really didn't know about these things, and I didn't understand. Like, I remember being a kid and looking at all these religious books, you know, that we were taught in schools, and there were like deserts and palm trees, and I was like, I don't understand why there's deserts and palm. There's no deserts and palm trees where I live. Here, there's only hovering pines and, you know, birches.
Yeah,
and. You know, and then I remember...
Yeah, that's important, by the way. That is an important thing that, you know, you need to relate even to not only the stories and stuff, and obviously there's correlations, there's life experiences maybe in those books that you can get, but, you know, if the environment isn't the same, if it's a foreign place, I wonder how deeply you can connect with it, to be honest.
Absolutely, because the spiritual center of that tradition is somewhere else. It's in the East.
Yeah.
And, you know, our spiritual center is not in the East. It is in the North.
Yeah.
You know, it is in the North Star. So it's like ex Borea Lux, look to the North. From North comes the light. That's the whole idea of all these Northern traditions that we have, is that we look North. And I remember being a kid in school and then seeing these pictures when we had, I guess it was some sort of comparative religion or something. And I remember seeing an image of an old painting of Thor riding on his chariot. And I just remember this sense of like how deep it resonated with me, this image of this fierce, strong god riding a chariot of goats and kind of taking one of the giants by the hair. And I think it's a famous, actually a famous artist's rendition from maybe the 18th century of Thor. And I just remember that it resonated with me, as did all this artwork from the Finnish tradition depicting all these images of Väinämöinen and this old ancient Finnish kind of shamanic knower god. And all these, the kind of artwork depicting the mythos. And it just resonated with me. It felt right. And it felt like that was my spiritual landscape. So I think it is a great tragedy that I, in a way, I've had to travel halfway across the planet to find my way home, which has always been here, which has always mm-hmm. been imminently connected to where I am. But I've had to spend half a lifetime seeking to really find it in a genuine and deep way. You know, I'm yeah. you know, nearing the mid of my life, and I sometimes think, what if I grew up in a world where this tradition was alive and I could have just dedicated myself into studying.
Exactly. Yeah. I agree. I was just going to ask you about that. You know, many times I feel like, yes, okay, it's the path that we take. It produces who we are today. And that's good. That's fine. But part of me does feel kind of not a regret and not a resentment. Those are too strong, I guess, of emotions. But I guess disappointment that I had to go on this like complete just weirdo journey just to kind of end up back where I was. I mean, you know, and I want to get your take on this, but for me personally, it was just this idea also that I wanted to unlearn everything. I needed to just totally disconnect from everything I've been taught. That included the Swedish school system, that included the kind of the mentality, the kind of democratic social, everything, the political system. I just wanted to get away from it. And so I went to the furthest edges of that I could imagine, which was the fringes of like of study and of spiritual traditions and all that kind of stuff. And eventually you find your way back and that helps you to find your center. But at the same time, I do feel, what if I just had some teachers around me or even parents that were more maybe encouraging to get me to go to those local traditions right away? What do you feel about this?
Absolutely. This is exactly what I'm talking about. We kind of have lost our, you know, in India they have this idea of caste. There's the Brahmins, and then there's the Kshatriyas, and then there's the farmers and the workers. So they have like a place for everything and everyone, and they have the idea of these Brahmins is that the Brahmins are like the upholders of the tradition, who keep the tradition pure and kind of keep the cosmic axis in its place. And so they have a very sacred role for their people. But we don't have those people for our traditions, for the traditions of Europe, for the spiritual pre-Christian, you know, inherent ancestral traditions of Europe. We don't have those people or that sort of caste. We don't recognize the knowers and the shamans and the kind of natural priests that we should have to uphold these traditions. And I think if there is a way, one of the things that needs to happen, if there is going to be a kind of revival of the ethos of the pagan ethos, is that we need to sort of start reinstating a position of such people that are completely dedicated to upholding these traditions that we have.
Yeah, indeed. So I'm showing some footage here, obviously, of some of the, you know, rituals and practices and all that stuff in India. And before we go in and talk more kind of about the northern tradition and stuff, and just tell us a little bit more about that and what you found in India, what you feel about it. Did you feel that you were out of place or in place there? Were you well received? Because I know that there's a lot of, I mean, let's be honest about that. There is a lot of, as you say, kind of people who search for experiences like kind of like it's a museum exhibit or something. You know, they go in just to have them, either to brag about them and put them on Instagram or something, or they kind of want to have some kind of, you know, fake, I guess, relation to it or whatever. And so that kind of has kind of put me off to it. But in your opinion, did you find something authentic there that kind of worked for you? Because obviously you did return eventually. So does that mean that your experiences there wasn't complete and kind of was yeah, complete for you? Or is there something lacking, I guess? That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, so my kind of immersion in the mythic and spiritual world of India took place over the course of, say, a decade or more. And so I wasn't that whole time in India, of course. My kind of immersion in India consisted of several journeys there, and then times where I would come back, but I would still be kind of immersed in the spiritual traditions and practices of India and kind of really trying to get into it. And so, of course, first when you enter India and you come into India, it's a very confusing, chaotic, at sometimes repugnant world, psychedelic almost. But slowly you kind of start sensing that there is an order to things in this strange land of 300 million gods, that somehow everything works because this is the way things have been done for, centuries. So eventually I met a person who was a sadhu, meaning a Naga Baba. A sadhu is a person in India who is this like shaman, renunciate. It's somebody who has renounced the ordinary world and renounced their caste and their family life and their occupation and become completely just committed to the divine, or seeking the divine, understanding the divine, manifesting the divine. And so they are often these wandering ascetic monks with long, these kind of dreadlocks reaching down to the ground and sometimes only covered in ash and so forth. And they too consider themselves to be the maintainers of Sanatana Dharma, this eternal tradition, which is the real name of Hinduism in a way. And so these warrior monks are kind of like one of the group that upholds this ancient tradition of India. And so I met a person who sort of granted me access to one particular branch of these Naga Babas, these sadhus, which was the Juna Akara, which is this very ancient order of the oldest and largest order of Naga Babas in the world. And I then immersed myself in their spiritual tradition as much as was possible for me, and went further into the tradition, and received a kind of initiation where I was given a mantra and a new name and all these kinds of gifts. And then I guess in a way my whole experience culminated in the Kumbh Mela in 2010, I believe it was, which the Kumbh Mela is the largest and oldest gathering of human beings on planet Earth for a magical, spiritual, or religious reason. And I think the year I went there, there were like 60 million people came there during that period of the festival to have their holy bath in the holy river Ganges, Ganga. And so this old, very old festival is also where these new initiations into, well, there you go. Now you can see the images of the...
I found some of that footage. Is this the festival?
This is the festival, and these are the guys. And these are the guys going, I guess they're coming back from their bath, because they're naked and kind of very rowdy and joyous here. So, it's crazy. And these guys, you know, they're not the Western idea of a yogi. It's right. This kind of meek, pacifistic, you know, vegetarian guy who does a lot of stretching.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys are warriors. You know, these guys fought the Muslims invading India, and they will fight and they will use violence to protect what they believe is the law of the universe. So this was my experience. I had an experience with them, and in this Kumbh Mela, where all these new initiations into this ancient order takes place, I also saw kind of the line that I couldn't and wouldn't cross. Because at the end of the day, I'm not Indian, and I will never become Indian. And they were like, in India, they talk about jati, which is clan, like tribe. And so I could feel that I had perhaps a jati of my own to connect with, tribes to connect with of my own in my homeland. And I also felt the call of my own gods. You know, I felt the gods in my own blood calling for me. And I realized that this is kind of the edge. I'm at the edge between these two worlds. And to go any further would mean to that you would have to kind of abandon your previous roots and your previous life completely. And of course, that's not something that's my destiny. And I don't really encourage that for most people at all in the West. And I think it's a big problem when Western people think that they can just easily adopt a foreign culture's traditions and just like become a Hindu.
Right.
You know, that's not really possible. It's extremely difficult. So I hope that people realize that in my book, I'm not encouraging people to go to India and find themselves. I'm sort of trying to spare them the trouble.
I was just going to say, I mean, it's like, that's kind of what the book is about, right? That it's about you made this journey and you kind of come out of the other end to a certain extent, and you realize, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, so explain this to us, how that happened. I mean, I guess it was this experience that we just watched that was part of having you feel like, oh, this is, you know, this is, I'm not fully with these guys. They have, this is their stuff. And again, as we said before, even though there might be some, you know, overlap way back in the Indo-Aryan tradition, obviously over time and separation through geography, you get very unique expressions of those similarities, and although that might be overlapped with some of the gods, etc. I still think that over time they develop their own practices, their own rituals and stuff like that. And that's one of the wonderful things. I mean, I'm not one of these that want to like merge everything or look at everything the same. I think that those separations that we have, that's a wonderful thing. I think we should, you know, preserve that as much as possible. But was there anything else in addition to this experience that made you like, you know what, I got to look back home? How was that process like for you? What was the trigger, and where did you begin?
I would like to state that, you know, this idea of finding this ancient tradition, this polytheistic tradition, it doesn't require you to abandon your own gods. So I had never, you know, abandoned the innate gods that I carried within me in my blood. I had never left those behind. It's just, I think the Kumbh Mela was in many magical ways just the culmination for me of this understanding that this is my destiny, is to come here to this ancient land and learn what I did, and then try to go back to my own native land and bring back something that I have learned to my people. Because I think this is the kind of archetype of Odin. If we look at the Nordic god Odin or the Finnic god Väinämöinen, these are gods of wisdom seeking who travel into faraway places, into dangerous places and distant lands to look for a treasure. They don't just travel because it's fun and exotic. They look for something. And this is the old, you know, journey of the shaman as well. He goes to other worlds to find something to bring back, to to his tribe, to his people, to help them. It can be a medicine, it can be a knowledge, it can be wisdom. So this was the kind of idea I had in mind. And I did visit India even after I had this realization, but it was never the same. Although I still have a love for India, a love-hate relationship with India, I would say. But yeah, I just understood that my destiny is to try to bring back something to people who really have lost their soul. And that's the people of not just Northern Europe, but Europe in general, I think. We have kind of displaced our soul, and I think we need our soul back. And this is, of course, this is the soul retrieval journey that's as ancient as man is.
You know, that's been one of my kind of points for a while, that I think our fall, which it truly is, I mean, it is a fall of the West that has occurred, has happened, maybe not primarily, but to a large part due to us, to a certain extent, abandoning our spiritual tradition. And I would even include Christianity in that. I don't even think we have to go to the pre-Christian tradition. It has been our willingness and our openness to accept other traditions above our own that has been our downfall. It's an interesting quality. It's a unique quality that you don't see among many other people, that you're so opening and so curious and so welcoming to other traditions. But it's a strength in certain aspects, maybe, because, you know, you can amalgamate a lot, you know, you can learn a lot, and you can get a lot of ideas and inspiration and stuff. But overall, we have abandoned those issues, you know, and the deeper personal connections. So I'm with you there. I think that there needs to be a kind of a revisiting of our own traditions and customs for us to be able to get back on our feet again. If we don't have a spiritual center, we'll never be able to find it politically or in the external world, which is, of course, a necessary point, aspect at this point, Aki.
Absolutely. I think we need to kind of find our, you know, in almost all of these European spiritual traditions, there's this idea of a central pillar or world tree or cosmic axis around which this whole cosmos operates. Is something I think that we need to find back, because we have to understand that this pillar is not only existent in the external world, but it is existent within us also. And without this understanding of what this means, there is no way that we can kind of defeat the problems that face us. Like, I don't believe in solutions coming from below, in a way. I believe that the solutions have to come from above. They have to come from a spiritual plane, ultimately. And that all other solutions, or only, let's say, only political solutions, for instance, they can only offer kind of small bandages to problems.
Exactly.
But we need to fix much, much deeper issues. Because we have had our connections to our own spirit and our soil cut. Like when Christianity arrived to Finland, for instance, one of their first missions was to cut down all the holy trees. Now, why was that so important, to cut down all these holy trees? It was because these holy trees were, for instance, embodiments of the mythic world of the people. And the Christians understood that when you cut down the holy trees, you sever the connections that people have with the land and with their own soul and with their own gods and spirits. And if you build churches where old sacred sites used to be, then you kind of replace this. You try to kind of re-channel that religiosity with this new religion. Now, obviously, this hasn't really worked, because the best aspects of Christianity that we have are pagan aspects of Christianity. The cyclical celebrations of the year, such as Yule, Ostara, Easter that we have right now, these kind of things are pagan. These are the things that pagan things that were incorporated into Christianity to make it somehow workable for the people of Northern Europe. But even then, it didn't quite work. Like, if you look at modern Scandinavia, including Finland, these are some of the most secular places on the planet. And so in Europe and in Northern Europe, first it was Christianity, and then Christianity in the 20th century and in the 19th century, Christianity was being replaced by a bunch of economic doctrines, which, although, you know, ostensibly atheistic or so, were trying to replace Christianity in a similar way. They were messianic political creeds. So I think, you know, new political creeds are not the answer, but we have to somehow find the archaic root of our being, the soul, again, and then bring that back with a vision into the future. Because I'm not one of these, you know, let's go to the forest and put on Viking garb and play around with axes and think that we're warriors. I don't believe in this kind of LARPing on any level. I think we have to take the essence of our traditions, the internal essence of our traditions, spiritual traditions, and give new form to those. And we cannot look like our spiritual gaze cannot be simply into the past only. Of course, the past is the wellspring of everything. So we have to look deep into the past. But from that past, we also have to cast a glance into the farthest possible future. I think only this kind of ethno-futurism, for instance, you could call it, or archaeo-futurism or something like this. Only I think that is the thing that can work for us. Because we cannot go back. We have to go forward.
No, of course not. And I think it's for us to be able to find, resolution to the problems. And you know, obviously the past proved itself to be our downfall, right? I mean, we ended up where we are now due to, well, many different factors, obviously. But as a summary, just looking at it, it wasn't strong enough, or whatever you want to term it. It wasn't powerful enough. And although many things were done to us, we were manipulated, and there were wars and all these kinds of things. I think you're right. I think the only way is to learn from the past and also use that tradition to stand on firm ground. But then there needs to be an extension and a vision of what kind of future we want to. And that will be both political, but it needs to be spiritual. That's obviously the big lesson that we're talking about here, that there needs to be a firm spiritual tradition. And as you say, that doesn't mean that you have to run around and play theater or anything like that. You know, it's if some people are awakened by having more theatrical experiences initially that leads to something more authentic later on, I'm fine with that. That's okay. But it doesn't end with those things, if you know what I mean. It's something far more deeper that we have to search for, right?
Absolutely. The external doesn't replace the internal. And for some people, perhaps they arrive at these things via these external things, and then they discover the internal dimension. And that is fine, of course. But my point being is that I do see these kind of, you know, to criticize paganism, there is so much of this kind of pseudo-religiosity, or sure, what Oswald Spengler termed a kind of second religiosity, where the people have lost touch with the fountain of their original religion, and they live in a world of the city and of bureaucracy, and they long for the youth of their original religion. This is the words of Oswald Spengler, and I think these kind of LARPy, things, they tend to kind of perhaps be an expression of that, of people's longing into something genuine. But I just think it's very important that people realize that that is a good thing. And of course, our customs and our culture and our handicrafts and arts and all these things that, you know, you see at a Viking fair or something, of course, these are great. But that's just like the first little step that you take.
Exactly. And just to extend that to other traditions, Aki, I mean, we could also say that about other existing religions, that they are costumes. They are external, fairly shallow expressions of something deeper. If the authenticity and if the inner dimension, if you will, to those things isn't there, then it is just LARPing. I mean, that you could say for any religion, no matter how holy it seems on the outside. If it doesn't mean something internally, but I get you. Please go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think so. Perhaps the power of Christianity is that it, or was when it arrived into Northern Europe, was that it was a centralized religion that was very cohesive and kind of centralizing also. It was something that could gather tribes from here and there and nations from here and there under its one kind of flag, whereas the pagan world was always local and kind of more separated and splintered, you could say, in a way. So I think that perhaps, although we need, I'm very much for the rediscovery of all pagan European tradition and traditions. But I think on a deeper level, we also perhaps need to understand what the common ground between all these European spiritual worlds and mythologies and kind of pantheons are. What's the common ground? And to understand that we actually have a lot more in common within Europe in its spiritual traditions than we have things that separate us. Because if we understand that there is such a thing as a European pagan spiritual tradition, then I think we are very strong if we find that again.
Yeah, that's a good point. So we're going to take a break in a little bit, but I want to make sure that people kind of get a little bit more gist of the book and stuff like that. Let's just touch on the title, because we didn't do that yet. The Kali Yuga, of course, the expression of this the deepest dark age that we are kind of in right now. Tell us why you used that in the title and what the significance of that is in relation to your book.
Well, perhaps one thing that also became apparent, I mean, you were asking about why I returned to my own land, you know, in a deeper sense later. Perhaps one thing that became very obvious was that the Kali Yuga was something that was happening also in India. Now, I've maybe perhaps talked about these Indian traditions and my experiences of them in a somewhat idealized way, because this idea of an ongoing decay and degeneration of these traditions is also happening within India, and this is the idea of the Kali Yuga. And the Kali Yuga means that the universe is thought of as cyclical, that it goes via four ages, beginning from a golden age to an age of iron and strife. And that is the Kali Yuga, and that is the age that we are living in now. And the Kali Yuga is spoken of in these old Hindu scriptures, for instance, the Puranas. And it is describing a world which has lost its balance, where the understanding of man's role and part is no longer understood. It's described as a kind of time when all spiritual traditions are being kind of perverted or degraded or sold, and nature is being destroyed and man is decaying, and into the minutest detail it is describing the world as it actually now exists, at a brink of all these great cataclysmic events, both in the East and the West. So this somehow always rose to the forefront in my travels, this Kali Yuga, just in the sense of I noticed how much falsehood there was in India, how much not genuine spiritual tradition existed in India. Because as much as India is home to all these wonderful, real and genuine spiritual traditions, it is also home to probably the the largest amount of hucksters and fake gurus on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we have to be very skeptical of this. And on another level, it is also a time of dispossession, where people no longer like remember who they are and what their gods are. And it is a time of these religions of the book, of monotheistic religions, meaning Christianity, Islam, Judaism. And of course, it is a time of strife. And so terrorism is a central aspect of the Kali Yuga. The fact that people commit atrocities in the name of their chosen prophet is a central aspect of the Kali Yuga. Now, as I was traveling in India, there were numerous instances where I came face to face with terrorist attacks that I nearly escaped and such. And when back in my early days, I was thinking, oh, it's good that these things are not really happening in my country or in my part of the world so much. And then they started happening here also, and there seemed to be kind of an escalation of these aspects of the Kali Yuga, of terrorism, which were always connected to one religion and one prophet committing these heinous acts of violence and murder. So Kali Yuga was something that the whole idea of it just appeared to me as I was writing about this and thinking about it, because there was something so apocalyptic about all of this. It wasn't like, this is not a, if you read this book, this is not a peaceful book. This is not like one of those feel-good books that you perhaps have read and where the traveler kind of, you know, has a few stones on the path, but then arrives and everything's fine. And this is not one of those books. So not for the faint of heart, you know. And that's my, that's the story of the book. And it's, of course, it's an ongoing story. Like I'm kind of writing the next part of my next book now, which is a natural continuation of Journeys in the Kali Yuga, which is, you know, people have to understand that this is not really a book about India. It is a book about the spiritual crisis of Western man.
Yeah.
And it is a story of homecoming. And so even though this book is very subjective and it's the story, my sincere story of my homecoming, this is also, you know, every man's story. This is a very old story, the hero's journey, the journey home. And so this book kind of ends in me finding home and understanding what my part in home is. And my next book then is me trying to describe what this home is. So my next book is tentatively titled Holy Europe. And it will be this quite massive book featuring many photographs and things of 9 different sacred worlds in Europe, ranging all the way from Iceland and Scandinavia, the Baltics, France, Germany, all the way to Portugal and Spain and Italy. So I am trying to find these things in Europe for the people who have lost them, in a way, for myself and of course for my people also. To point towards the holy is what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, interesting. Let's definitely talk a bit more about that here in the second segment. We're going to take a break in just a couple of minutes. But obviously, guys, if you're curious about this and want to kind of find out more about this journey, definitely pick up a copy of the book, Journeys in the Kali Yuga, Pilgrimage from Esoteric India to Pagan Europe. It is available on Amazon. It's Inner Traditions, which is the publisher. And of course, we'll have links down in the description and whatnot. You can also, of course, find links from Aki's website, which is simply akisederberg.com. We'll add a link to that as well. Are those the best places to get the book, Aki, would you say? Or do you prefer them to buy it from somewhere else due to commissions? I know Amazon like rips people off. I hear from all the authors.
No. Amazon and any good bookstore is
okay.
Fine.
Yeah. Sounds good. All right. Very interesting. Well, stay with us then, folks. We'll take just a short break here. We'll return with Aki Sederberg in the second part. We'll see you there. All right, guys. So join us in part 2 as we continue with Aki Sederberg to kind of dive into the Northern tradition a bit more. We talk more about the pre-Christian heritage, not only of Northern Europe and Scandinavia, but also in Europe overall. We'll talk about how to reawaken some of these spiritual traditions and how to kind of implement them in the modern world and how we couple that with science. It's an interesting discussion, so I do hope that you join us. If you want to check it out, if you're not already a member, head on over to redicemembers.com, sign up for a membership there with us. That's the best way that you can support us as well. You get access to exclusive videos. You get access to videos first as we publish them. We have Weekend Warrior. We also have, of course, tons of shows for you in the archive. So definitely check it out. Thank you for joining us here in part one. We'll be right back after a short break.